This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit chevrolet.gm.ca.
Hi, I'm Dave King, and you're listening to The North This Week. A couple of weeks ago, we heard that there are more Russian planes in Arctic skies right now than there have been since the Cold War. Well, it's been about that long since Canadian fighter jets were a regular sight in the skies over Happy Valley Goose Bay. But if you look up in Goose Bay these days, guess what you'll see? And guess why they're there? Because Russian bombers are testing the North American defense system. We'll hear more about that in just a little bit. We'll also hear an incredible story from a man who fell through the ice on a snowmobile in the Northwest Territories and barely lived to tell about it. But we're starting off today in the Yukon, or with a Yukoner anyway. He happens, in fact, to be a long way from home at the moment, but given where he is and what the weather is like here, I suspect he likes it that way. Neil Hartling owns Nahanni River Adventures. If you've never heard of it, or even if you have, you might want to check out their website. It just beat out the likes of Air Canada and the Canadian Tourism Commission for Yahoo's Big Idea Chair Award. It's a pretty big deal for Hartling's little outfitting business. CBC's Sandy Coleman reached Neil Hartling by satellite phone in Baja to talk about it.
So congratulations. I understand the website has won not only one award, but two?
Yes, exactly. We won our category of small business. We won the overall of all the websites in Canada, and then we won the Yahoo Big Idea Chair Award. And I'm reveling on that, sitting here on the Sea of Cortez where I'm sea kayaking. Right now I'm watching the sunrise as I talk to you, enjoying balmy weather.
and taking more video for yet the next website update?
That's right. Well, interestingly, this is very apropos because we're now offering trips to Baja and Belize and next year Galapagos. And, of course, the web is the perfect medium, and our website, they tell us the best in Canada for relaying that information.
So what does that mean, Neil? What does getting this recognition represent?
Well, for us, it's great. It's not only myself and those in our company, but those who've helped us build the site, Outcrop, Jason Rayner in Whitehorse, and in the old days, Andrew Robolak had a big hand in it, and we've had guidance from people associated with Tourism Yukon and economic development in the past as well, and. So it represents recognition for, I guess, being somewhat visionary in that when I first set up the website and for some years afterwards, I was on national marketing committees and the big hotel chains and car rental agencies around the table when I would try to get them to embrace to get a website to going a national website for Canada. They were treating it as a fad. They were hoping it would disappear. Well, in the meantime, operators in the Yukon and Yukon Tourism were providing leadership in building the websites and benefiting from it. And Yukon has, because Yukon's a small jurisdiction, the operators there have had to rely on these kinds of strategies to make a go of it and be competitive in the world. And it's been the perfect medium for that. I like to say that the internet has been to adventure travel. It's been the biggest advent since the advent of nylon, which you can imagine in adventure travel was a major advancement.
Neil, any idea how many people looked at the website in this voting and what it could mean for your business?
Well, I don't know how many have looked at it in the voting, but our traffic has been up. We get well over 50,000 unique visitors a month, and that's gone up. So it's significant, and it probably will continue to do so as a result of it, because it's fairly high profile. In fact, and the other funny thing about the prize is that the Yahoo Chair Award actually comes with a chair. So it's a large, overstuffed, almost cartoonish looking living room chair, blue and sort of Yahoo-esque looking. And it apparently arrived yesterday in Whitehorse, I'm told, by UPS. And the Yahoo people were quite giddy about shipping this chair all the way to Whitehorse.
So you get to sit in it for a year in the location of your choice, and then you return it?
I think I get to keep it. So it's apparently where one is to sit and think of big ideas. It's a coveted award because the big hot ad agencies around the world covet the Yahoo Big Idea Chair. There's Yahoo Big Idea Chairs in Madison Avenue and Silicon Valley, and they're highly everybody longs for the chance to sit in the chair and have their picture taken. So they want the chair to be seen, in a raft in the Yukon, maybe slung beneath a helicopter, things like that, or a float plane dock with a float plane in front of it, that sort of thing.
I have an idea. You will deliver that. Neil, thank you so much, and congratulations again.
And Neil, thanks, Andy. I'll be thinking of you here down in Baja.
Yeah. Rub it in.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Neil Hartling somehow manages to split his time between Whitehorse and Baja these days. That's where Sandy Coleman reached him last week by sat phone. Thanks for that interview, Sandy.
All the good times are past and gone. All the good times are over. All the good times
Kim Beggs is one of the Yukon's best-known singer-songwriters. She's also one of the Yukon's only known singer-songwriters south of 60. But things don't look very good right now for the little record label that helped Kim launch her career and break into the southern market. Caribou Records is the Yukon's only multi-artist record label, and launching careers is its stock in trade. Kim Barlow released her first four CDs on Caribou, including her Juno-nominated album Gingerbread. The Cuban band Valle Son traveled all the way to Whitehorse to record both its debut and sophomore albums with the label. But as winter sets in here in Whitehorse, Caribou Records is putting a freeze on its operations. Keitha Clark reports on how Caribou Records is faring in the battle between adaptation and extinction.
The only multi-artist record label north of 60 began as a dream between a wildlife biologist and a dobro player. Take a chance on me. In 1995, David Petkovich, a fish farm founder turned artist manager, and Bob Hamilton, a roots musician with a recording studio, decided to make a compilation album to capture the energy of emerging Yukon artists.
There were certainly a lot of talented musicians and songwriters in the territory, but there wasn't much in the way of an outlet to release music. From there, we decided, well, if we're going to put out a CD, maybe we should form a record label to release the CD under. And that's where it all began.
To get the label off the ground, Petkovich and Hamilton approached the Yukon government for a grant. They also invested considerable amounts of their own finances in sweat equity. The risks paid off. Southern distributors began to take note.
Initially, there was a really strong interest, especially from our distributor out of Vancouver, who at that time saw a growing interest in folk music and indigenous music. Our first two projects we brought to our distributor fit both those, that genre. And so they were really excited to see that we were up here and trying to develop artists from the north.
Whitehorse singer-songwriter Anne-Louise Genet appeared on Caribou's first compilation album with the group, The Ladies Auxiliary. Genet's music career was in its infancy when the album was released. She says Caribou Records has done a lot for emerging Yukon artists.
Caribou Records really nurtured a burgeoning music scene at a time when it really needed that, and bringing things on to a national level, encouraging us to be more diligent and work at our craft and try and produce something that was ready for the rest of the country to hear.
Honey, won't you take a chance on me?
Caribou's early years were exciting. Northern Toshone singer Jerry Alford's album won a Juno for Aboriginal Recording of the Year, and the Caribou herd was growing.
Alaska Highway miles, he rolled the end in the beginning.
Kim Barlow had just started songwriting while working at a coffee shop when Caribou Records approached her in the late 90s.
I was kind of shocked and delighted and said, sure, what the heck, and made Hamina and worked with Caribou for the next 7 years, I guess.
Barlow liked that the label had a family business feel to it, and that worked well with her off-the-grid lifestyle.
When I started out, I was living in a cabin up on Squatters Road, and I didn't have electricity or a phone or a computer or any of that stuff, so I'd come down to the office and use those resources.
But just when Barlow released her first album in 1999, the music industry was thrown into a revolution.
And it was also right around the time when free downloading started, and you know, after Hamina was released, it really went wild, and I think that record sales dropped all over the place. And
Caribou was hit hard by music downloading sites. In the past year, record sales have dropped 40% to 60%. The label only sold 3,000 albums this year.
There seems to be some type of psychological effect that resulted from the media suggesting that the CD is going out of style and that everyone's going to get their music off the internet, and that impacted the number of CDs being sold in Canada and around the world.
To cope with the cut in record sales, Caribou has had to lay off its two staff members. Pekovich has had to go back to being a full-time wildlife biologist, and the label has stopped making new albums. In an attempt to survive, Caribou has joined the downloading revolution. It's hired a broker to add its albums to iTunes and other music websites. There are some advantages to distributing music via download, says Petrovich. You save on the cost of making CDs and labels, and you also have instant access to a global audience.
At Caribou, when we wanted to reach an audience outside of Canada, we had to go to trade shows over in Europe or the USA or wherever and try and negotiate distribution deals in specific territories where we might select off the USA as one territory, Germany, Australia. And it was a lot of work just trying to set up those distribution channels.
But for Caribou, the financial results of digital downloads have been meager. Pekovich says it's hard to make money when 80% of music is downloaded for free.
In order to make that transition where the downloading could really serve us and the artists well, we would have to invest a lot of new money in developing a marketing strategy and implementing it. And I don't know if we're prepared to do that at this stage. I think the days ahead are very difficult for Caribou at this moment.
Kim Barlow, who moved to Jericho Beach Records to release her fourth album, says Caribou Records and local artists waited too long to deal with the downloading disaster.
Napster and stuff like that came up. I think that we should have gotten together and said, okay, what are we going to do? How are musicians going to survive in this new situation?
Petkovic says small record labels need to change their strategy if they're going to stay alive. It's increasingly easy for independent artists to record and upload their music themselves onto the net. In order to be financially viable, record labels are going to have to focus on artist management. Petkovic says he doesn't have any plans to return to his earlier career as an artist manager. He has young children and says it was too demanding on his time and finances the first go-round. With a third of musicians migrating and record sales dwindling, Caribou may soon be extinct.
All the good times are past and gone.
While the label's future is uncertain, Pekovich looks at its past with pride. Caribou Records released 24 albums, received 3 Juno nominations, and won 1 Juno. The label has left permanent tracks on the Norse musical landscape. For CBC Radio, I'm Keitha Clark in Whitehorse.
Wish to the Lord I'd never been born or died when I was young. I never would have seen your sparkling blue eyes or heard your beautiful song.
Thanks, Keitha. David Petkovich spoke to Gian Gomeshi this week on Q on CBC Radio as well, and you can find that interview by visiting cbc.ca and searching for Caribou Records. I'm Dave King, and this is The North This Week. What are Canadian fighter jets doing in the skies over Happy Valley Goose Bay? Well, keeping an eye on Russian bombers, of course. Several CF-18 fighter jets have been flying missions out of Labrador recently, and they're on alert because Russian bombers have been testing the North American defense response. CBC's Peter Cowan is in Goose Bay, and he put a call into retired General Paul Manson to find out what this activity is all about.
There are really two types of activity. One would be a routine sovereignty patrol, that these airplanes on a random but a fairly common basis would go and fly navigation flights into the far north of Canada, coming back to Goose Bay, or perhaps even landing at other air bases in the area. That's one way in which we can show a presence up there. The other possibility would be that the CF-18s could be on some form of standby so that if, for example, a Russian bear aircraft is seen by a long-range radar flying towards the Canadian Arctic Archipelago, then the CF-18s could be scrambled. They could go out and intercept those airplanes, fly alongside, as we were doing all through the years of the Cold War, just to let them know we're there, we're keeping track of them, and making sure that they don't enter into Canadian airspace. So those are the two functions that I would guess the Air Force is performing with its F-18s out of Goose Bay today.
What can you tell me about the Russian Bear aircraft?
It's a very old airplane. It's a big nuclear bomber. It was designed to carry nuclear weapons over very long distances, and of course during the Cold War that meant primarily flying in World War III, flying over the North Pole, down across Canada into the principal targets that they would see in the United States, industrial centers and population centers in the United States. But in spite of the fact that it is a very old airplane, it flies high, it flies fast, it's got very long range, so it still, even these many years later, still could represent some sort of a potential threat to North America. But the Cold War is over now. I suspect what the Russians are doing is using their airplanes to assert some measure of what they consider to be sovereignty over the Arctic Ocean. They have, as we know, planted a flag on the pole at the bottom of the Arctic Ocean. They are declaring a primary sovereignty control and interest over the Lomonosov Range, this huge underwater mountain range, which it potentially has all sorts of natural resources that can be exploited. So I think the Russians are playing an assertion game as well by sending these large bombers in the direction of the Canadian Arctic.
So once they've been detected, take me through the timeline of what happens next.
When an aircraft is detected by the North Warning System or by some other means, the information about this detection is passed to NORAD headquarters, which is down in Colorado Springs in Colorado. That information can be passed absolutely instantaneously through satellites and through other means. The whole system can react extremely quickly, and can then the signals can be sent by NORAD to air bases as appropriate to launch aircraft, if necessary, to scramble, fly out into the vicinity of the oncoming aircraft, do an intercept, and it can be picked up by the aircraft radar, and the aircraft radar can navigate the fighter aircraft alongside of the approaching bomber-type aircraft. All of this can be done in a matter of an hour and a half, or 2 hours, depending on how fast the bomber is approaching and where it is first detected. But the system can and does work very, very quickly. But that again, is in the context of a Cold War. Although the same systems exist today and the same techniques can be used today for detecting oncoming aircraft that seem to be presenting some sort of a threat to North America, it's not the same sort of critical scene that would exist if there was a threat of a nuclear weapons being carried over North America, for example.
How long do you think this sort of cat-and-mouse game is going to continue?
I think probably it's going to continue for a good long while yet. There are a number of things taking place right now that lead me to believe that we're really just getting into this. It's a new regime, a new environment that Canada is facing. It was triggered, of course, by the slow but certain increase in temperatures, global warming, which is leading to a very rapid melting of the Arctic ice. It's even been suggested that within 40 years, the Arctic ice might be completely melted in summertime in the Arctic. And you can imagine what that means in terms of seaborne navigation. And when you combine that with the exploitation of undersea resources and mineral resources in Arctic islands, there will be, in my estimation, a lot more traffic, sea traffic, air traffic, even land vehicles, in the coming 10, 20, 30 years. And that's why the Canadian government and others are starting to look far more closely at the Arctic than they had in the past 20 or 30 years, where, frankly, the Arctic dimension was neglected by consecutive Canadian governments and by the Canadian people themselves. But that's all changing. And the trigger has been global warming, but there are other factors involved as well.
Retired General Paul Manson was speaking with CBC's Peter Cowan. Thanks for that take, Peter. I'm Dave King, and you are listening to The North This Week. And for most of the North, November is the month when the ice starts to get thick enough to hold snowmobiles. Starts to get thick enough. It's also the time that overeager riders start to take some pretty scary chances. Trevor Teed knows exactly how much taking chances like that can cost. 17 years ago, he decided to take a risk on some thin ice. It was the morning of Remembrance Day. He was leaving Yellowknife with four of his friends to hunt caribou. They made it as far as Harding Lake, 50 kilometers east of Yellowknife. And that's where the snow machine carrying Trevor and his friend Billy Balsillie went through the ice. Trevor told his story shortly after it happened in 1993 to CBC's George Tuckeroo.
There was a couple of minutes where we attempted to get out of the water. The skidoo went right out of sight, as did our guns. We swam around and tried to grab onto ice, but the ice was too thin. It was maybe less than half an inch thick where we went through. And the ice just kept breaking and breaking and breaking. And my clothes were getting heavier and heavier, and that cold water was exhausting me rather quickly. And I was quite lucky that around that time I began to remember all the survival training I had taken a few years earlier in college, and I recalled that I should attempt to stay as still as possible and expend as little energy as possible. So my friend and I, we began to converse, and we tried to stay as still as possible, but it was very difficult because our clothes were starting to pull us down. After about 5 or 6 minutes in the water, we gave up hope. We recognized that in all likelihood we were going to die. All attempts at rescue were still a long ways away. The boys that were with us were still on solid ice about 1,000 feet away, and they had no means to reach us, or at least that we so believed. Billy and I began to talk to each other about what should happen if we got out of the water. We asked each other if he got out, I asked him to go and speak to my wife, my children, tell them I'm very sorry, that I loved them, and I apologize. And I guess I was apologizing for the risk that I had taken up at that morning, because, in fact, we did know there was bad ice, but we just dared ourselves to cross. And Billy told me much the same thing. it was about that time when all of a sudden I got a thought into my head that one of the guys on the ice had a sleigh that floated, because one of my past friends who just died this fall, Baby Kazan, had told me he ran a net paddling a sleigh out there, and the sleigh that he paddled was identical to the one we had on the ice. And I began to yell to the boys on the ice to use the sleigh. It floats. I was facing away from them and didn't see them. Billy related what I had said, and they heard, and they began to unhook the sleigh and try to get to us. But they were so far away that we didn't have much hope of survival. So again, we talked to each other, telling each other we were sorry for what we had done in our whole lives and how much we loved our family, and to make sure if one of us got out to deliver that message. It was about that time that I began to lose my strength and power, and I began sliding into the water downwards. I felt the water go into my ears, and I stretched out my neck as far as I could, and I still couldn't keep my chin above water. And I tried desperately to clutch the ice and pull myself up, but I had no strength. I remember my fingers sliding across the ice as I tried to grip the ice that was about a half inch thick. And then I remember the water going over my ears, over my nose, and my hat floating off. I remember distinctly thinking that I was going to die because my hat came off and all the heat was going to escape my body. And I began to sink into the water, down, down. I remember thinking how dark it was down there. It was a kind of a huey dark. It wasn't dark as night, but it was dark with a kind of a hazy light, misty light, I guess, from the ice cover. And I just continued to sink. I gave up all hope of survival at that point. And as I sunk, I began to have these thoughts run through my mind. I remembered in 1971, my dad died in the water like such. And, I found that very comforting. You know, I was dying just like my dad, and I thought it was great. That's a very confusing statement to make, but I really felt comforted by the fact I was dying the same way my dad did. And here, just a few minutes before that, I was very fearful. As I had that thought running through my head, I started sinking further, and then I recalled when my dad died just how awful I had felt as a young boy, a 15-year-old boy, and how awful my brothers and sisters had felt, and my mother, and how remarkably different our life was following my dad's death. And all of a sudden, I remembered again that I was married and I had kids. And I thought, those poor kids and my poor wife, they're going to have to go through what I went through as a youth. And it hurt, and it hurt a lot. And I continued to sink. And then suddenly, I seen this body sinking just below me, and I found it very strange that there was somebody else sinking, and I guess I initially thought it was Billy, and I looked, and I could see that his arms were bent up in front of him, sinking, his hair was floating up, and by God, it was me that I seen. I was looking at myself sinking, and I realized then that I was dying, or else I was dead. But I remember also thinking that I must be still alive, because I'm still thinking. And all of a sudden I got this weird sensation. I could smell my dad. I remember hunting with him as a youth and sleeping in the same blanket, and I just remembered the scent of my dad, and I could hear people around me. I couldn't see anyone. And I desperately then tried to snap out of it and get out of the water, and nothing happened. Nothing. And it was about that point I gave up all hope of everything, and then I gave one last try at trying to save myself. I said my first prayer that I remember saying with any honesty. I said a prayer not so much for myself, but for my wife and kids. And that prayer consisted of three words. It said, God, save me. As soon as I thought those words, everything changed. There was suddenly a bright, 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 bright white light, the whitest light I ever saw in my life. And it was so bright, and I could look at it and I could see. It didn't blind me or anything, but it was such a white light. And again, I could smell my dad. And I had a sense my brother was near and several other people. There was a whole crowd of people. It was as though they were welcoming me. And then I began to hear music. Not any kind of music I've heard on this earth. It was the most beautiful, comforting music I ever heard. And then I noticed, as I looked into the light, there was a figure behind the light. A long-robed figure. It looked as though that figure had long hair. I couldn't determine whether it was a man or a woman. And that person or being or whatever it be was standing with their arms open, welcoming me. And the singing and the music increased. And all of a sudden, I just felt like a baby. I felt like a baby in my mother's arms. And it was as though I was given a decision to come. And I wanted to go with the light because it was so comforting and so beautiful and so all-loving. And I had yet in my mind the thought of my wife and kids. And I wanted a chance to show them that I was a better man than I had lived up to that point. I wanted to show them that I cared. I wanted to hold them and hug them and kiss them and tell them I loved them because I never often did that in the past. And the next thing I knew, I was shot up to the surface as though I was shot out of a gun. I came out of the water, on top of the lake, I mean, and I had strength. I had such power in me that I swam to the ice and I leaped out of the water and tried to get right onto the ice and it broke and doubled up and I went back again. I took a look around. I was thinking clearly. I saw where the ice had broken, and I guess one piece went down and it shot out of the water and flew up and landed on top of another piece, doubling its thickness. And I swam to that piece and I put my arm there. And I looked back to see how my partner was doing. And as I looked at him, he died. He just died. And he went down. I remember I yelled at him to let him know that I was back. I was alive still, and there was something great down there. And as I came out of the water, at the same time, that light vanished. Billy died at the instant that light disappeared from my view. And I managed to hang in there. I was told later I was underwater for close to 1 minute. I hung on to the ice, and Clem Paul paddled out to me, tied me to the sleigh, and paddled back. I was in the water for about 1 hour. It was 30 below outside. They got me, Clem and Tommy Ross. Murray Dick went for help. They pulled me out of the water. They threw me into a sleigh and drove 5 miles or so to a cabin, built a fire. There were so many little miracles that day. They lit a fire with a lighter that was frozen, covered in ice. I don't know to this day how they managed to start the fire. There was wood laid out in that cabin. There was blankets, beds. They did everything they had to do, and I survived.
With many lakes throughout the North still unsafe for sledding, Yellowknife's morning show decided to rerun Trevor Teed's story last week. They also invited Trevor in to talk about his experience. CBC's Kirsten Murphy began by asking Trevor how it felt to hear that tape again.
For me, what stands out mostly is that I survived and Billy didn't, and of course I have my regrets that he didn't survive, and I have happiness that I in fact did. But when it comes down to the experience itself, there's a whole batch of different things that I found emotional in listening to the tape again and by memory. I guess the strongest emotions for me were recognizing that I was dying in a similar fashion to my dad, actually smelling my dad, and feeling like a baby when I saw that white light, and
the strength I had when I got back to the surface. Those emotions I remember quite clearly, as well as some things that I didn't discuss on the tape, like my reaction when Clem actually reached me with the sleigh. My initial reaction was to try to jump out of the water and into the sleigh, and I nearly tipped the sleigh over. And had I done that, of course, Clem and I probably both would have perished on the spot. But Clem, being the individual that he is, he threatened to knock me out if I tried that again. And I actually heeded him, and he told me to go to the end of the sleigh, and I did. I went to the bottom end, and he tied me in position and told me to stay really still and not to upset the sleigh, and he paddled back to hard ice, talking to me all the way. I remember the conversation that we had, not as clearly today as I remembered back then, but he talked to me all the way, trying to keep me awake and conscious, and it took some time to get back to the hard ice.
And in the interview, which was done just shortly after the accident, you said that it had changed your life. However, now another 15 or so years have passed. How has it since changed your life?
Well, the biggest change, of course, is that I removed drugs and alcohol from my life. For me and my family, those two things were problematic at the time. And today, since that interview, I've not been involved in that lifestyle. And having removed those elements from my life, I was able to put more of my time into my family and into our family business. And if I learned anything, I learned to never give up and to always try my hardest at whatever I do. And I carry those things through today. The other thing I've learned with some difficulty is that if people ask me for help, I seldom turn them down, particularly if it's a sincere request for help. It's difficult to explain, but when I was in the water and I was dying, I asked for help, not only from God, as I said in the interview, but I asked Clem to help me, and I asked him to take my word that a sleigh floated, and he took my word and paddled out to me in this darn sleigh. And that alone, those events alone have brought me to a point in my life when people ask me sincerely for help that I'm very hard-pressed to turn them down.
And earlier you said that, of course, you regret losing your friend Billy Balsley, but have you reconciled that you lived and he didn't?
Well, I have to a degree, I guess. What's remarkable about that event, I talked about my dad dying in a similar circumstance. Well, in September 12, 1971, my dad and Pat Balsley and another individual overturned a boat. And my dad, Ralph Teed, died, and Pat Balsley survived. Pat was Billy's first cousin, and 19 years later, there was a Balsley and a Teed in the water again, and this time the Teed survived and the Balsley passed away. And I found that very ironic through the entire process, even to this date, that the ties that we have from one generation to the next seem to carry on despite ourselves.
And there was a group of you that day, Clem Paul being one of them. Do you still stay in touch with those people?
I do. Murray Dick was there. Murray left the scene early, and he went for help. He had to drive his snowmobile back across Harding Lake and a couple small lakes, Reed Lake, get on the Ingraham Trail and get into a vehicle and drive for help. And he actually did that. This is one of the small miracles that I talked about earlier. He was driving for help, and he actually had a collision on the highway. He ran into a renewable resources vehicle with a wildlife officer in it, and they had a radio in their truck, and they radioed for a helicopter. Tommy Ross was also there, and Tommy has moved south, but I saw Tommy regularly while he was here, and I still on occasion see him. And then, of course, I see Billy's children from time to time, and his ex-wife as well.
And so many amazing things, good things, came out of this. Your sobriety, your reunification with your family. But if you had to do it again, if you had a choice whether this would happen to you again or not, what would you choose?
Boy, I would have chose to stay close to shore with a snowmobile. it's as much as my life changed for the better, I can't help but feel that Billy's family had a little different experience and probably not so good, unfortunately. And the whole thing is that it was a needless accident. Billy and I took a chance when we shouldn't have. We attempted to cross ice that we suspected might not be safe. We thought we could get across with speed on the snow machine, and we paid a consequence for that. Billy paid ultimately with his life, and he paid the larger debt, and I've have to live with that we made a mistake. And I'd like the message to get out that safety first, and when it comes to snowmobiling in the wintertime, early winter at any rate.
Do you still go out?
Absolutely, yeah.
Tell us advice you would give to people out, and advice that you heed yourself when you go out now.
Well, the biggest thing is always keep in mind to be safe. If possible, check the ice. Don't travel in places you're not sure of in the dark. And, it's probably better to travel in pairs, but I break that rule quite often. And teach your children well. I'd hate to have my children go through a similar experience that I went through.
Trevor Teed was speaking with CBC's Kirsten Murphy. Thanks for that, Kirsten. It brings us to the end of The North This Week, but if we leave you wanting more, why not visit our website at cbc.ca/north. You can send me an email at dave_king@cbc.ca. And if you're in the North, you can always tune us in on your radio dial. I'm Dave King. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.